Lise Doucette has been reporting from trouble spots around the world since the 1980s. Coming up, the BBC's chief international correspondent tells us how one hotel in Kabul helped her get to know the people of Afghanistan and learn how much they've gone through.
In a country where so much has been lost, their deeply ingrained sense of hospitality still remains.
Next time you're in Paris, historian Cullen Jones suggests you look at how its monuments form a straight line from the Louvre all the way to La Défense.
It's like a sort of skewer through French history with enormously rich, juicy morsels of French history all the way strung along it.
And a nature photographer from the Outer Hebrides shares tips for capturing the impressive scenery you'll find in Scotland.
You get these incredible shades of light that come from the heavens as if it's just pinpointing little things for you to look at. We call them the silver jewels of the earth.
Come along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It promised to bring modern sophistication to Afghanistan when the Intercontinental opened as the first luxury hotel in Kabul back in 1969. And somehow, it's still standing today. As BBC journalist Lise Doucette points out, the stories of the hotel and its staff provide a kind of people's history that reveals much about the character of the people of Afghanistan. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, Lise Doucette tells us how the Intercontinental served as a refuge, not only for foreign correspondents reporting on Afghanistan's wars, but also for the Afghanis she got to know who've worked there. And later in the hour, a Scottish photographer offers pointers for where you should aim your camera to bring back a souvenir of the wild majesty of Scotland. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with a closer look at France and the roles it played for most of the 20th century as one of the world's major powers. Keep in mind, France has a history that encompasses some 2,000 years all the way back to Roman Gaul. To help us better understand what we're seeing in the world's most visited country, let's check in now with historian Cullen Jones. He's written a number of works on French history, which he distills in his latest book. It's called The Shortest History of France. Bonjour, Cullen.
Thank you, Rick. Nice to be here.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about how our sightseeing can help us give us a rack upon which to hang an understanding of 20th century France, but it's got to start in the 19th century in what, 18... What year was the Eiffel Tower constructed?
Well, it was, I can tell you in two ways. First, it was 1889, and secondly, it was the centenary of the French Revolution of 1789, quite deliberately so, that it was a republic celebrating itself as a republic, but celebrating itself also as a world power. And in that year, they had a world fair, essentially, like Chicago in 1893. They beat Chicago to it. And it was basically a place where the world came together. There were individual pavilions. It was a tremendous sort of cosmopolitan success. And one of the things which they wanted to do to show the world was the strength and the power and the capacity of French engineering genius. And they got Mr. Eiffel to put together the idea of an enormous tower, which probably would be taken down, possibly at the end of the exhibition. Possibly it would last for 30 or 40 years. And here we are with what is obviously the icon of Parisian identity still with us, very much so.
So this is so interesting. On the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, that would be 1889, right?
Yeah.
They built this to have a big celebration. And just to kind of underline how modern it was like this giant erector set, and they could order up all the parts. They knew exactly what they needed. They assembled it on a strict schedule, and they could disassemble it on the same strict schedule, but they decided to leave it up, thank goodness. But in so many ways, it was the symbolic kicking off of the modern age, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think the fact that France was announcing itself as back in power, if you like. It had lost the war against the Germans in 1870-71, had a big economic and social and political crisis. But now it was back, and it was back as a world power, a global power. It really emphasized the colonies and you know, seemed to be one of the global powers of the late 19th and into the 20th century.
And now this is when France comes, I think, into the fore as a modern cultural kind of power. It's always been a political and a cultural power, but now this is modernity. And we get this delightful time until World War I, of course, where it was sort of the garden party of Europe. And speaking of garden parties, you had Monet and the Impressionists, and you could go out to Giverny and see those water lilies and those weeping willow trees. You've got this concept of vacations and workers' rights and avant-garde. Tell us about France, just culturally, at the dawn of the 20th century.
I think France, at the dawn of the 20th century, it is seen as probably the most attractive cultural site in the whole of the world. I mean, the fact that tourists absolutely, you know, line up down the road to come there in huge numbers, it's really the moment that France, Paris in particular, the whole of France, becomes the tourist destination number one for the world. And it's backed up, you know, in great literature, in great art. What is so interesting is that, you know, the French capital, and the French capital is really important in all aspects of culture as well as politics, has always been the place where, you know, the biggest art schools are, the École des Beaux-Arts and things like that. But what happens, particularly with the Impressionists, is that it becomes the site, if you like, of their paintings. So we all think of Paris in the 19th century through Monet or through Pissarro or something like that. So then it moves into Cubism. Again, France is absolutely in the avant-garde. Indeed, the very idea of the avant-garde is something in literature and in culture and in a way in politics as well that is very much associated with France.
That is, it's so interesting, Colin, that my image of France is with dappled light. And dappled light is all about the way an Impressionist would paint a street scene in Paris. And you mentioned all the tourists were coming in, but also all of the artists, the musicians, the writers. It was just the place to go. It's no wonder Picasso left Spain and decided to live in Paris, the cultural center of it all. And then we have the rude awakening of what was called the Great War. They didn't know there was going to be another one, so it wasn't World War I yet. But tell us about the impact of World War I and World War II on France, because we have a tough time imagining the cost of a battle of attrition where two societies, France and Germany, decide that we're going to just bash our heads against each other, and we calculate that the other guy's going to bleed white and drop first. And they kept on bashing and bashing and bashing, didn't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the trench warfare that established itself just a few months actually after the beginning of the war, and people hadn't really expected that in quite the same way. They thought probably it would be a war, a rapid war of movement, but it settled down because of basically the strength of firepower into these trenches led by generals who were completely out of their depth and felt that they could, with just some sort of justification, send vast numbers of men over the top and to their certain deaths in many, many cases. The loss of population by France and Germany was just, I mean, we're talking millions and millions, and of all the countries who took part in the Great War, France was proportionally the most affected. And that had a really big impact in all sorts of ways on what happened next, because first of all, France wanted to take it out on Germany, and particularly in, because France was very economically weakened by the war, but it continued that enmity against Germany, which obviously you get the payback with the rise of Hitler. But it also meant that, you know, the population was really lacking, and it was, you know, vast numbers of war wounded and all the rest of it. The presence of the war lasts a long time. Honestly, if your viewers go around, they'll find in the smallest village, they'll find a war memorial. On that will be a list of the names of the people who died in the Great War. It is stunning.
You know, those war memorials are really, really emotional. And every time I'm in a small town in France, I have to pause at the war memorials. And sadly, the war memorials are built with empty plaques for names for future wars on them. And there continue to be names to put on those plaques, you know. But nothing was like the devastation of World War I. Colin Jones is joining us from New York right now on Travel with Rick Steves, where he's working on a John and Constance Birkeland Fellowship at the Komen Center with the New York Public Library. He's helping us sightsee 20th century French history. Colin's the author of The Shortest History of France. His earlier books include The Cambridge Illustrated History of France, Paris, Biography of a City, and The Smile Revolution in 18th Century Paris. You'll find more about Colin and his work in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Anytime you get a chance to get your brain around a country's complicated history before traveling there, it makes your sightseeing so much more rewarding. And here's an example of that, Colin, and I'd like to finish our conversation just with this thought. When I'm on the top floor of the Louvre Museum, the formerly the biggest palace in Europe, and now it's the biggest collection of paintings, I believe, in Europe, I can look out and I see the horseshoe-shaped palace of the Divine Monarch, Louis. I don't know which. It was a big, huge palace for one of the Louis, and before they went to Versailles. And then you see the Champs-Élysées, the Grand Boulevard, and it reaches a bluff where you've got the Arc de Triomphe. And then beyond the Arc de Triomphe, you actually see a bigger arch, which is the Arch of the Defense, way out in the outside of the center of town. It's all one long axis. And the Parisians see this as kind of a planned and a symbolic axis. What does that grand axis mean to you, from the Louvre to the Arc de Triomphe to the La Défense?
Yes, it's like a sort of skewer through French history with enormously rich, juicy morsels of French history all the way strung along it, really, from the Louvre, which, as you say, was the royal palace for when the kings of France were in residence in Paris, which wasn't always the case, from the late Middle Ages onwards. What I'd also say is you mentioned some of the sites, but actually the fact that what's not there is important, because in front of the Louvre, until the 19th century, was a lot of, like, tenement buildings, really. The poor lived really close to the kings at that time.
Oh, yeah.
That was wiped away in the 19th century. And also another palace, the Tuileries Palace, which was the victim of the Paris Commune in 1871. Huh. So that opened up that space through the Champs-Élysées via the Place de la Concorde, as you say, and the obelisk there, then through the Champs-Élysées right up to the Arc de Triomphe, which was put there in celebration of the revolutionary and Napoleonic period, but in the sort of 1830s, 1840s, right through to the great commercial center of La Défense, and in the heart of that, and very much on the axis again, another lump of on the skewer, if you like, the great arch of La Défense, which celebrates the commercial and economic sense of and value of the French.
So it's kind of like you got the Divine Monarch, the at the Palace of the Louvre. Then you go through the Place de la Concorde, where the guillotine was set up, and that's where they cut off the head of the
Absolutely,
king.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then what used to be the king's carriageway is now the people's way, the Champs-Élysées, leading up to the Arc de Triomphe, this grand Napoleonic celebration of French nationalism and the people. And then beyond that, you've got a celebration of international trade and a global economy, the Place de la Défense. It's so much fun to bring meaning to your travels by just understanding the context. And Colin, what you've really illustrated quite well in your book is you don't need to be a huge scholar as a traveler to get joy out of the history and the art. You just need to get your hands on some information and get the context, and then I think your travels become much more rewarding. Colin, thank you so much for joining us and inspiring us to do exactly that as we look forward to our next trips.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Colin Jones looks at how the European Union has helped to overcome a century of adversity between France and Germany. It's in an extra with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look at photographing the rugged beauty of Scotland in just a bit. But first, the BBC's chief foreign correspondent tells us how reporting from the finest hotel in Kabul has helped her understand Afghanistan since the 1980s. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. On Christmas Day in 1988, just weeks before the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, journalist Lise Doucette checked into Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel for the first time. She was struck by the hotel's faded grandeur, once a gleaming symbol of sophistication when it opened in 1969, and by the hospitality of the staff who kept it running amid the turmoil. Since then, Lise has become one of the world's most respected journalists, and as the BBC's chief international correspondent, she's covered conflicts from the Arab Spring to the war in Ukraine. Throughout her career, she's returned many times to Afghanistan and to the Intercontinental Hotel, watching the country and the hotel endure wave after wave of violence and chaos, and yet somehow the Intercontinental Hotel never closed its doors. Her new book, The Finest Hotel in Kabul, tells the story of the real people who kept those doors open in a sweeping yet deeply intimate portrait of a battered country. Lise, welcome and thanks for joining us.
It's really an honor to be on your travel program, Rick.
Well, Lisa, I went through Afghanistan as a backpacker way back in the 70s and was charmed in a peculiar way by Afghanistan. Of all the places you could report from, what first drew you to Afghanistan?
Exactly what you just said, Rick. I often say, as a joke, but as you know, in every good joke, there's a lot of truth, that nobody goes to Afghanistan once. There is something about the people, about their sense of self and character, which means that it's very easy to form relationships with them and friendships. And I have found through my travels, when a people has a strong sense of self, they also have a strong sense of humor because they can laugh at themselves. And for me, humor is the universal language. When I first went, as you said, on Christmas Day, my first visit, not only was I, as a person, I was taken in by the strength of the Afghan people, how they were standing up to the Soviet occupation of their country. And of course, as a journalist, I was smack in the middle of history. The Cold War of the time, where Kabul was in the crosshairs, a Soviet-backed government battling the Western-backed Mujahideen, it was the Ukraine War of its time, the most grievous war in the world and the biggest migration crisis. All the eyes of the world were on Afghanistan. And there I found myself as a young journalist, and I was totally, totally taken in.
Now, you have used as a sort of a way to understand Afghanistan the story of the Intercontinental Hotel and its staff. And you're a foreign correspondent who's been in zones of conflict all over the world. It always seems there's one hotel which is sort of the oasis, the refuge of the journalists. Tell us a little bit about, just on a global sense. It just always seems to me there's this one place where you almost huddle together listening to bombs blowing up in the distance and trying to get internet access.
Yes, isn't that strange paradox about journalists that we all love the scoop or the exclusive, but we hunt in packs. As soon as you hear that, well, these were the days where people didn't have phones in their pockets. Do you remember those phones that are plugged into the walls? Oh, landlines?
Whoa.
And in Afghanistan, there were three or four in the whole country, only three or four international telephone lines that you had to book. But most of them went through Moscow. But curiously, one went through the Glasgow Telephone Exchange. So the people who went to that hotel, this modern palace of glass and steel, which had been the first luxury hotel in Kabul, went thinking that at least there was a chance of having a telephone line. There was food worth eating. And by word of mouth, by reputation, they do tend to surge toward the one place because the worst thing is not being able to get that story out.
Yeah. Now, first of all, your book does a great job of teaching through the people you've met. And you've already mentioned how it's sort of the wonder of the country. How was it that you were able to feature people in the hotel to tell the story you wanted to tell about Afghanistan through this very troubled last half century?
As you know, Rick, in choosing to tell a story, first of all, we have to say what kind of storytelling are we going to do and what kind of prism. As literature, they would call it a conceit. And I've always been fascinated ever since I read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood about how you can use the conventions of a novel to tell a story which is true, where the history literally comes alive and the characters come alive. So in choosing a prism, I needed to have a place where history literally lived in its walls. And this is the story of the Intercontinental Hotel, that it has somehow survived. It has managed to stay standing, where waiters keep waiting, cooks keep pots on the boil, the housekeeping staff still snaps those fresh white sheets across the bed. Never mind that there were times when it was called the worst hotel in the world. And I thought it is a metaphor for a country still standing. And in a country where so much has been lost, that their deeply ingrained sense of hospitality still remains.
And you opened up your book, you started during the middle of the U.S. withdrawal in 2021, and you're describing a chaotic disruption of a hotel wedding party as the Taliban is breaching Kabul. Tell us about that.
So if anyone, and I'm sure many of your listeners were following that dramatic, in many ways shocking news that after two decades of international engagement, that Kabul fell and was taken over by the Taliban again, that they were back in power. But I'm sure that any of the headlines, no one talked about a wedding party that was completely destroyed. No one talked about the anguish of the brides and the grooms. And that's why I was trying to tell a different kind of story. Because in the news business, what do we see? We see snapshots. And if it's a country of troubled lands, what do we see? We see people running away from the bombs. In 2021, it's people running in a panic to the airport. You see people standing in the rubble of their homes. You see them in the darkest, the most difficult moments, moments of enormous emotion and grief. But what happens in the spaces in between? Life goes on. And I have found in places where death is literally at the door, the only antidote is really to live. And so the weddings go on. So I was trying to bring people in to show the everyday rituals of life that all of us know so well, a wedding in a hotel.
And it's not that much difference in Kabul, Afghanistan, or Des Moines, Iowa. You know,
yes.
That's the beautiful thing about it. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're getting a view of Afghanistan through the story of its first luxury hotel. Our guest is the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. She first checked into that hotel in 1988 to report on the final days of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Her new book tells the story of this resilient landmark and the people who kept it open through decades of turbulence and heartbreak. It's called The Finest Hotel in Kabul, A People's History of Afghanistan. You know, Lise, I really like this idea of presenting an intimate side of a story that we read about in the newspapers and see on the TV news, by focusing not on the big political actors, but the everyday people. And with your connection with this hotel, you knew the staff, the cooks, the housekeepers, the receptionists, and so on. You wrote so vividly about these people. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the names correctly, but Hazrat, fascinating, the housekeeper, Abida, who the first female chef after the fall of the Taliban 25 years ago, and Malali and Sadak. That was a younger staff after 9/11. Can you talk a little bit about a couple of these people and how it can be such an instructive insight into that culture?
Rick, what I really admired most about the main drivers of this story is how much pride they still kept in working for the Intercontinental Hotel, even though it was no longer part of the luxury chain. And someone like Hazrat, who's the oldest person in the book, he's now 70-something, but he's still so full of pride that he had been trained by the real Intercontinental when the global chain ran the hotel. And every time the hotel changed hands, because every time the rulers changed in Afghanistan, the rules changed at the Intercontinental Hotel. And he would press upon them that he knew how to run a proper hotel, that they should listen to him. And when I approached him in the hotel and he remembered me from the days when I'd lived there for nearly a year, I said, "Well, Hazrat, I'm thinking of writing a history of the hotel. Would you like to be part of it?" And immediately, I could see his face just beamed. And then he actually mimicked the gesture of flinging over the shoulder white, soft, plush towel, remembering the wealthy tourists who would glide across the marble floor with the white towel over their shoulder, wearing their white shirts and white skirts on their way to the swimming pool. And of course, that oozed a life of privilege, a life of ease. And that was not his life. It was a completely different world. He was the eldest of 10 children in his family. His father had died when he was a teenager, when an electric heater fell into the water. He had to quit high school. But he had such dignity and he had such an amazing memory as well for all of the details as to how it was to work in this hotel.
Was it a matter of pride for them to offer world-class hospitality even in their humble corner of the world?
Well, when it was a proper Intercontinental, 1969 to 1980, when the Intercontinental chain pulled out, a friend of mine, Thomas Gutierrez, who's one of the world's experts on Afghanistan, and he went to Afghanistan as a Peace Corps worker, and then he stayed on. He was so excited when I called him up, and I said, "Oh, Tom, what do you think about the Intercontinental Hotel?" He goes, "Oh," I could hear it all the way down the line from the United States. He said, "The Intercon changed life in Afghanistan." He said, "I, for the first time, ate escargot in the Intercon." He goes, "We didn't have aubergine, you know, in the United States." And he still remembered what it was, even for an American, to be eating at the Intercontinental Hotel.
You know, when I was in Kabul, my takeaway, and this was a long time ago, but it just didn't seem to fit Afghanistan very well. And I saw people in
you know, different kinds of uniforms relating to their job, whether they were in the customs or the traffic patrol or whatever. And it didn't seem like they fit in their uniforms. It seems like they were forced into those uniforms and they would have rather worn their regular tribal robes and so on. It just was a weird misfit to me. Did you get any sense of that? Because I had come from the countryside.
Yes, we'll see. And unfortunately, Rick, you were doing a kind of travel. You would not even have gone past the doorman with his red coat and shiny gold buttons on the edge of Kabul. They knew they came from a different world, but I never got the sense from they would still say to me that, you know, Hazrat said it was one of the two top hotels in the world in the 1970s. Wow. They still talked about it as the finest hotel because they'd never been in another hotel, certainly not a five-star hotel.
Yeah.
But you're right to say it was a rarefied world. It was only for those who had a fortune, for the royals, for the privileged families, for the well-heeled foreigners, for the diplomats. You had to have money, you had to have status in able to go up to that hill. Now, decade on decade, it changed until you actually got some rather unseemly characters when the hotel, when the country was run by the Mujahideen, as they're called, or by the Taliban.
Lise Doucette is our guest from London right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She's the BBC's chief international correspondent. Her new book is The Finest Hotel in Kabul. Lise is known for her extensive reporting from conflict zones around the world. She started reporting from the Ivory Coast in 1983 and from Pakistan and Afghanistan in 1988. Her work has won her an Emmy, a Peabody, the Edward R. Murrow Award, 15 honorary doctorates, as well as an OBE and the Order of Canada. Lise, I was fascinated by your account of Abida, who was the first female chef after the fall of the Taliban in 2001. What's your take on the reality of women in Afghanistan, and what did you want to share in your book about that?
Oh, Abida. I so love Abida. Here she is. She's in her mid-50s now. She's a single mother. Like many Afghan women, she lost her husband to war and became a widow. So Abida raised 8 children on her own. She's illiterate. She can't read. She can't write except her name. And yet she educated all of her children, 6 of them, to university level. And wow, could she cook? And that was her pride and joy. She had first worked in the Kabul Hotel in their kitchen. And then when the Mujahideen came to power and then the Taliban, she was forced to stay at home. So when she heard that news in 2001 from the new leader, Hamid Karzai, announcing that Afghan women have rights, you can return to your jobs, she was like a flash out her door. She raced as fast as she could down to the new government office. And Abida Nazari, who could barely write, wrote her name in that ledger. She became the first woman to sign up for a job.
But today, is it rolled back to the way it was before?
Oh, this is one of the saddest of circumstances now. And I'm sure your listeners know about the situation in Afghanistan. Taliban leaders, when they were in the peace talks with the Americans and Afghans, said, oh, we're not going to rule the same way we did in the 90s. We've learned our lessons. Mm-hmm. Women will have all their rights to be educated. Women will hold down all of the jobs, except maybe they can't be president or judges. But in reality, many would say that it's even worse in Afghanistan now.
Lise, we only have just a little bit of time left, and there's 2 important topics I would like you just to comment on. First of all, I'd like your take on the failures of the United States' involvement and the disaster withdrawal leading to the resurgence of the Taliban. Do you think that was inevitable? And when we think about the literally trillions of dollars that my country spent there, what did we get for that? What are your thoughts on that?
Mistakes were made by both sides, by the Afghans, by the international community, including the Americans, who were the most powerful player militarily and financially. I think it has taught us, and I'm not saying something other people haven't said, is that you must walk carefully when you go into a culture and in a country which isn't your own. Was it all for naught? I would say that the international engagement created a space to help nourish the most educated, the most connected Afghan generation in history. Afghan girls and boys, Afghans in general, dream bigger than ever before.
Oh,
that was an
accomplishment.
Good.
Well, there you go.
Yes. But of course, some would say that how could you have allowed us to dream like that and now our dreams are crushed?
Yeah.
But those young Afghans still in the country, Afghans outside the country, are still fighting for a different kind of Afghanistan. On my last trip to Afghanistan 2 years ago, a founding member of the Taliban told me 95% of Taliban do not agree with these harshest of edicts. They understand that girls have to go to school. They understand that women should be able to develop their potential. But they're unwilling or unable to challenge the clique at the top. But someday, Rick, they will. They will push back.
That's encouraging. And Lisa, the final point that I'd like to get your take on is just the danger of underestimating the spine of a country. History will marvel at how this small, impoverished country humbled the USSR, and then it humbled the United States of America. There's got to be a lesson there for future adventurous foreign policies.
Yes, never underestimate a people, and it's not in our gift to deny a people hope, to deny people the courage of their own conviction. Yes, it's a rather improbable history that the ragtag army of the so-called Mujahideen freedom fighters, granted they were then well-armed by the Americans and others, they'd like to think they defeated the Soviet Empire. They didn't bring it down on their own, but they certainly nailed a few nails in that coffin. So similarly now, when people say to me, oh, there's not much hope in Afghanistan, we from privileged society, it's not in our gift to deny Afghans the hope and the optimism, because by supporting their desire to have a different kind of a country, we're actually helping to make that happen, however long it will take.
Lise Doucette, thank you so much for writing The Finest Hotel in Kabul, and thanks for joining us now with your inspirational insight into that country that is a big part of our story, whether we like it or not. We're all in this together, and if we can just learn about each other's realities, I think the world can be a better place. Best wishes in your work.
Thank you, Rick. You know, those, as you like to say, those stories far away are not far away at all. They're our story, too.
Lise Doucette tells us how some of her fellow reporters tried to one-up their competitors in Kabul. It's in an extra from today's interview. You can hear it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, a professional nature photographer from the Hebrides shares pointers for shooting the perfect souvenir photo of Scotland. We're at 877-333-RICK, and by email, it's radio@ricksteves.com. When he's not leading tours of his Scottish homeland, you can often find James McClatchy with a camera in his hands. Scotland has a special beauty and a special light, and as a photographer, he knows how to catch it. James, or Seamus in Scottish, joins us in the studio now with his tips for capturing the ambiance, the culture, and the landscapes of Scotland in photographs. James, thanks for being here.
Hi, Rick. Love to be here.
Boy, you live in one of the most beautiful corners of the world, the islands off of the west coast of Scotland, the Hebrides. And when I think about it and when I look at your photographs, it must be just perfect if you love photography. Describe your homeland and how that relates to your photography.
My homeland's an incredible environment of changing light, changing colour. You're absorbed into nature every time you go out. And the greatest thing about being there is the challenges of trying to capture something that most people don't see, whether it's in the rain, whether it's the huge ocean waves. Recently, I had waves there that were over 18 metres high after a storm. I was the only one on the beach. But sometimes you have to take that risk and that challenge to yourself to go out and do it. But then in other days after storms have gone by, you get these incredible shades of light that come from the heavens as if it's just pinpointing little things for you to look at. We call them the silver jewels of the earth. And you see these shades coming from the clouds and they illuminate little bits of the landscape. And trying to capture that mood with a camera is really quite challenging. And for me, it's really a battle between the alter ego of nature that I try to capture. There's this constant challenge with nature banging on the shore. In the winter, the colours are a lot more muted. And how do you transform that colour from the darkness of the winter into something kind of special? So I try and create images that are really surreal, that sometimes you will look at that image and you'll think, my God, there's no way that could ever have been. But it depends on the camera settings, it depends on everything else. And every time I go out, I learn something new about the camera and about how to process.
So it sounds like you need to be both a poet and a technician. You have to have the gear and know how to use it.
It's very difficult at times. I started off with very small cameras, and I always tried to maximize the opportunity where I could take a picture. But as I gradually learned the processes, I realized that I had to get more expensive equipment. I had to go and do different things. But it is quite technical, but it's also very abstract as well. And one of the greatest things to me is, how do you frame a shot and give a composition? You've got to draw somebody into that shot. You've got to make them wander with you on the journey right through the picture. And that, for me, is fascinating. Sometimes you do it without thinking.
Right.
And then other times it is a thought process. It is a deliberate process that is there.
What are some dimensions of Scotland that you want to capture in your photography for other people to appreciate?
When I look at Scotland, we reinvented our own history after Culloden. And the images of Scotland were this romantic image, this misty image, the glens, the beautiful darkness, the beautiful moods, the ambience and the tranquility that is always there. And all around Scotland, we have that in abundance. Scotland, if you're in a city like Edinburgh or Glasgow, you could be there for weeks, for months, just photographing that. And the challenge for most photographers is, all we ever see is sunny pictures of places, but the moods of the rain, when the lights come on in the streets, when you look at the top from Calton Hill down onto Princes Street, and you just catch the last glint of the sun over Edinburgh Castle. Mm. If you're there in that moment, capturing it, and everybody else is walking around you, they're not seeing it. They're moving from it. You there are absolutely absorbing it. And also, one of the things as well in cities is going down closes and things like that. You can remove the people by a process within the camera in the same shot, so you can actually get the clear streets. So the camera is this amazing, magical tool that creates this incredible, surreal environment for you.
The camera is almost a blessing because it helps sharpen your eyes to see things that the typical tourist can't see.
Yeah, and also light. I love northern lights. I'm one of those people who chase the northern lights.
Yeah.
Now, the northern lights come in different times of the year.
What light are you looking for? Because we have the magic hour, we call it.
We have the magic hour. We have the blue hour, as we call it. And the problem with most people when they do photography, they do it in midday time when the sun's at its highest.
Yeah.
The light is totally glaring.
Yeah.
Most photographers will go out early morning. They'll go late afternoon. You'll stay till dusk. You'll try and capture the sun.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things that I found this year was about darkness. And I was out to the guide, and they taught me to do light painting with the camera. And I asked them to tell me what darkness was, and they said, there's no such dark thing as darkness, only darkness in the human soul. And when I came home from that trip, I started to go out into my own darkness and trying to bring in beautiful light and break and split the dark.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with James, or Seamus, McClutchy. And James is a photographer, and he happens to be stationed in a place that would be just a delightful place for a photographer to live, Scotland. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Preston's calling in from Austin in Texas. Do you have an experience with photography in Scotland?
Yeah, well, I don't, but I actually am looking for some tips. I really enjoy architectural and landscape and wildlife photography. And one of the things on my bucket list is to visit the Isle of Skye. My family's lineage can be traced back to there, and so I've always wanted to go and visit. In addition to that, I want to go and see the puffin migration. So I didn't know, wanted to get your tips on maybe the best times to visit to maybe see the best of what Scotland has to offer in nature, but also in anything you might be able to offer in terms of seeing the puffins and how to make that a success as a photographer.
All right. Thanks, Preston. So, James, sure. First of all, the Isle of Skye, great place for a photographer.
Oh, my God. Skye is a journey into this amazing landscape. It draws you in every angle. And the first thing with Skye, you come to the Skye Bridge. You look at the Skye Bridge, that connection from the mainland to the island. And it's as if you're going on this magical journey there. There's the mountains behind it. You then head into Skye. A lot of people talk about the fairy pools.
Uh-huh.
You can go down to Glenbrittle. You take a walk out this pathway, and suddenly these pools begin to appear. And the higher up you go, the more beautiful and absorbent the colours become in those pools. There's waterfalls there, depending on the time of year. You head out.
And by the way, that's a short walk from the car park.
It's a very short walk,
so yeah. This is important. You got to walk, but you don't need to walk miles. Sometimes you just walk 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, and you get to these amazing places where you're in tranquility and you're away from the road.
And the other thing about Skye as well, as you're coming through Skye, there is so much to absorb. In the summertime, if you go up there in June, July, you've got 18 hours of daylight. So as a photographer, you've got this magical time to play around with. You've got you go out into Slickahan, there's these amazing backdrops. And one of the things that I've found is really important to try and do is things like long exposure, where you're starting to, if there's a movement in the wind, you're getting the clouds coming over there, they're sort of line themselves up. Everything is really beautiful. Heading out onto the west coast of Skye, you're looking out towards Rum. And the best place that I've ever found for
looking out towards Rum, that's an island.
It's an island just nearby, off the coast. And there's a little road that you go down to Yolgal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a boat there called the Bella Jane. And they'll take you to what I call the place where angels rest before they go to heaven, in a place called Carushk. And you climb a little ladder there and you come into this beautiful backdrop of the Coolin Hills of Skye.
Oh.
And there's this amazing, magical loch down below it. And when you set the camera up there, and you can put yourself in the pose, because Turner went here at one time and painted a painting.
The great English painter, Turner, the romantic painter.
This, to me, was the greatest journey I ever did. I'd spent 20 years trying to go to Carushk, and when I went there, I totally felt I'd come to heaven. Now, you were talking about puffins. Puffins start to arrive off the west coast of Scotland around about the 10th of May. Mm-hmm. So any time from May right the way through to the second week in August today. But I would go May, June, July. The best islands to go for puffins is St Kilda. You can go up to Orkney as well. But if St Kilda is a top destination to go if you want to see all the seabirds, gannets, bonksies, everything like that, there's 1 million seabird there.
St Kilda, that's way far away, isn't
41
it?
41 miles into the Atlantic.
You have out in the Atlantic.
You go through the Hebrides. But Orkney itself is incredible.
Orkney's great. Yeah. Staffa.
Staffa is incredible as well.
So if you go out, all the tourists go to Iona and then you extend on to the next island, which is uninhabited, Staffa. And I was blown away by the bird life there, including the puffins.
And the puffins will sit almost next to you. You can almost pat them. And you can use a small camera. This is a great thing about Scotland. You don't necessarily have to have the big equipment. But if you're on a journey, I would give myself 2 weeks to just start going to Skye and into that.
You need time when you're a photographer.
Yeah,
you can't just run it. It's just not click, click, click. You guys, because when I look at your photography, I think this is a man that's got photography as his priority, and that's chasing the light. Preston, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Tour guide and photographer James McCletchie posts stunning landscape images of the Scottish Hebrides on his website, jmcletchie.com. By the way, today's interview is from the Travel with Rick Steves archives. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Walter's on the line from Epping in New Hampshire. Walter, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Rick.
What are your thoughts about photography in Scotland?
Well, we had the lucky chance to go up to Scotland, and my grandmother was a Scot, and her folks were from around the area of Glen Nevis. So when she passed away, we decided to go as a family over there to visit, and spectacular country, absolutely beautiful. We had a chance to go to Edinburgh, all the way up to Inverness, and over to the Isle of Skye, and it was just an incredible family vacation.
Mm.
And we want to go back, and my question for photography is that during a great portion of the time we were there, we ran into some really rainy weather. So a lot of the pictures came out dark. Everybody that saw the pictures wanted to know if it ever stopped raining in Scotland. And it, what can you do if you go on a vacation and you run into overcast and rainy conditions to take photos that stand out and give an idea of basically how nice the place looks?
All right, Walter, we'll leave that to James here.
Well, it depends, of course, what you're using. A lot of the mobile phones today that you use, they have a Pro app on them, and you can adjust the white balance on them, you can adjust the aperture. One of the things that a lot of people fail to do when they take photographs, particularly in the rain, is how do you capture the raindrops? You have to put a faster shutter speed on there, you increase the ISO. But one of the things that a lot of people don't do is they don't put on the flash. If you put a flash and illuminate those raindrops coming down there, the whole scene itself starts to take a different mood.
Huh.
If you then look at it depends on the time of day as well you go out. If you go out in the late afternoon and if the street lights are just coming on, you start to get these moody effects, this moody lighting that comes through there. and that really starts to bring out the thing. The biggest problem as well with rain is the colours are very, very dull, so you do have to adjust it there. Remember that most people who are using the top digital SLRs were shooting in a format called RAW, which is almost like a negative, so you are able to actually adjust when you develop that photograph. But in the rain as well, the most important thing to do is to take something to cover the lens itself, to cover the camera. And if you're going to do that type of photography, a tripod can sometimes be very useful as well when you're doing
it. You know,
when
the sun does come out with a heavy cloud cover, it gives this amazing, powerful color with a dark sky.
Oh, yes, and in particular places like Glencoe. If you're in Glencoe just after a shower of rain, everything has got this sparkle in the grass, the mountains, the rivers are running, and sometimes you get this rainbow that just comes through your shot there that just suddenly adds the colour that you want there into it. Also, just wait. Sometimes in Scotland, we say we've got seven seasons in one day. If you wait half an hour, that picture will come through there. I've done the same thing as you with the smaller cameras and things like that. I've gone home and I thought, yeah, I've got a great shot, and then I look at it and it's dark.
Pretty dark. Because we think that when we do our TV show, when it's cloudy, the colours don't pop. I like that word pop, and when the sun's out, things pop. But as getting back to that heavy cloud cover, sometimes you kind of go, we've had a long day, put the cameras down, call it good. And then, because it's cloudy, but there's that little sliver of open light at the horizon. And when the sun hits that, the whole world just gets like this amazing ray of light that comes in on an angle with the lid on it from all the clouds.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. And it just draws you into it. And that's, for me, the beauty of photography. Photography is an art in itself, but it's the art of celebrating nature.
Walter, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the tips.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with James McCletchie about photography in Scotland. Our email is radio@ricksteves.com, and Amy in Royersford, Pennsylvania, emailed us, and she writes, "My husband and I visited Scotland last year and took many good photographs, but I realized I only took a few pictures of the wonderful people we met along the way. I caught Scotland's beauty, the landscape, but not its heart. How would you suggest I photograph the people of Scotland?"
That's a very interesting question. If you stay in the cities, you tend to have the hustle and bustle. Everybody's running around, racing with their lives there, so it's not so easy to capture that. I would start to move into the rural areas, heading out into places like St. Andrews. As you're going along there, you start to see quite a lot of agricultural people in the fields. You start to look at the beautiful blooms in the summer when we've got the crops on top of the fields, the wind's blowing, and you see the farmers in the fields. You move further up into the highlands of Scotland, you start to see the sheep, you start to see the red deer, you can start to see that beautiful thing there, and you get the people working with the dogs as well. A lot of it is chance. You could be going along the road, there might be a farmer on the road. They don't really mind if you get out and take a picture, because that whole scene is something that's a part of your journey. I'm very fortunate where I live, because we have a lot of small-scale farms that are out there. I go out and try and capture that industrial look with them trying to do their work in all types of weather. So it's really about going into the remoter areas.
Yeah.
One of the other things you could probably do is, in particularly in Glencoe like that, you can go out with one of the rangers there, and they'll take you into the valleys, and you might get some hill walkers walking and standing on top of the hills. So you've got these incredible silhouettes that we have in Scotland with somebody looking out onto that landscape, which again allows you to come back and show that picture.
And it almost exaggerates the vastness of the landscape when you have a solitary figure silhouetted on it.
Yeah, and the greatest thing about the solitary figure is it's the unknown.
Yeah.
When you take people into a photograph, the interaction between you and what you were originally trying to photograph, the nature, changes. It brings a totally different balance there.
Uh-huh.
So you then have to refocus that shot to show that connection from that person in that landscape. And this is where you start to get that incredible joy there. Edinburgh closes are a really fantastic way of catching people as well.
Edinburgh?
The closest,
the little alleys.
Yeah, because there's always one or two people just walking down there.
One nice thing about that is they might not be in the glare of the sunshine. If you get somebody in the shade, it's more evenly lit.
It's beautiful, those closes there, and not a lot of people do it.
Right.
But if you just set up the tripod and you wait and somebody walks down, and then they just get to the very end, and you've got this beautiful silhouette with the beautiful stonework of Edinburgh all around there.
When it's framed right,
yeah,
you get the depth, you get the stone, you get the light hitting the stairs, you get the silhouette of those people.
And the other important thing as well is never let weather deter you.
Right.
Because Scotland, we do have a lot of rain.
Right.
look at the water, look at the puddles, look at where people are walking, look for the shadows of those people coming across that puddle. And then you will have the double shot. You'll have the reflection in the water and you'll have the person as well going through it. And that again draws you into the picture. It creates this amazing ambience.
Just break the norm. Too many shots are from eye level with the sun right on somebody and just, you know, it's kind of predictable and boring. I want to just finish with a couple of thoughts. Scotland and tranquility. Where do you find tranquility?
Tranquility comes, first of all, from within. It's how you go out into that environment and how you then absorb that tranquility. Taking the camera out with me then allows me to manifest that tranquility into a, hopefully a tranquil scene at the very end.
You've got such a beautiful garden of nature that you live in, and you've got such a rich culture. How do you connect the culture with the nature through your camera?
The culture is quite easy. I try and place the ancient culture we had as well. We've had a culture that goes right the way back to 5000 BC, more or less. Uh-huh. And the past is always present wherever I go. And then if you take those monoliths and put them into the scene, black and white is a very good way of absorbing that part of your culture in there. But also just going to events where people are participating, capturing the mood. Sometimes we forget that people create a mood as well. The smiles, the laughter, the jolliness, the dancing. Scotland is an awesome playground for a photographer.
James McCletchie, thanks. This is an inspiration. I want to go back to Scotland right now, but first I want to learn how to use my camera better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Learn more about our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show whenever you like at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Every year, over 30,000 people join our expert guides on a Rick Steves Europe bus tour. And about half of our tour members are return travelers. Details for each of our 40 itineraries, including departure dates and prices, are at ricksteves.com. And for a candid and fun-loving insight into each itinerary, don't miss our archive of hundreds of tour scrapbooks created by tour alums competing in our annual contest to win a free tour. And independent travelers can also learn from the day-to-day descriptions of our smartly designed tour itineraries. All of that is at ricksteves.com.